Welcome to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Coplin. Featuring stimulating in-depth interviews with special guests from all areas of the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Coplin.
Welcome to the show where we balance the intellectual with the creative and explore whether we have more in common than divides us through thought-provoking conversations. For the topic hour, I go out and about and talk to people on the street about a wide variety of different subjects that affect us all, both locally and globally. And for this, the arts hour, I interview local, national and international guests from all areas of the arts. The show combines a debate topic with an arts interview because discussion and creativity are two of the most vital ways we engage with the world. I feel balance occurs through truth distilled from many places, creating cohesive understanding. This week, as my special guest from the arts, I'm pleased to be featuring the award-winning artist and author Enrique Martinez Celaya. I was fortunate to have the opportunity to talk to Enrique at his studio in Los Angeles in some time he set aside in between painting for an upcoming exhibition and his university teaching commitments. I'm featuring a three-part series of interviews with Enrique, so look out for the follow-up shows in coming weeks. Enrique is an artist who works predominantly in painting, but also in sculpture, photography, poetry, and prose. He trained as an artist as well as a physicist and early in his career invented several patented laser devices before abandoning physics for art. His artwork has been widely exhibited internationally and is held in the public collections of international institutions such as the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, the State Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg, the Moderna Museet in Stockholm, the Museum der Bildenden Kunst Leipzig, Germany, and the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, amongst others. Enrique is the author of papers in art, poetry, philosophy, and physics, and several books, including Collected Writings and Interviews, 1990 to 2010, and On Art and Mindfulness, Notes from the Anderson Ranch, as well as the Artist Book Guide, which was later serialized by the magazine Works and Conversations. Born in Cuba and raised in Spain and Puerto Rico, Enrique began his formal art training at the age of 12 when he became apprenticed to a painter. He developed an enduring interest in writing and philosophy whilst in the turbulent cultural and political environment of 1970s Puerto Rico. He received a Bachelor of Science in Applied Physics and a minor in Electrical Engineering from Cornell University, California, and a Master of Science with a specialization in quantum electronics from the University of California, Berkeley, where he was a Regents Fellow. He attended the Skowhegan School of Painting and Sculpture and earned an MFA with the department's highest distinction from the University of California, Santa Barbara, where he was also a junior fellow at the Interdisciplinary Humanities Center. He is the first person to hold the position of Provost Professor of Humanities and Arts at the University of Southern California, is a Montgomery Fellow at Dartmouth College, and a Fellow of the Los Angeles Institute for the Humanities. Enrique is committed to the education and formation of artists and sponsors programs for children, provides scholarships for artists, and assists schools in developing their curriculum. In 1998, he founded Whale and Star Press, which publishes books on art, poetry, art practice, and critical theory. He's worked in collaboration with scientists, entrepreneurs, writers, musicians, and architects, including the Canadian rock band Cowboy Junkies, the poet and Nobel Prize-winning chemist Roald Hoffman, and the novelist Mary Rakow. His work has also been the subject of several monographic publications. I spoke to Enrique at his wonderfully inspiring studio in Los Angeles, with multiple vast rooms both to paint in and display his work, as well as a small library and a beautiful lush garden featuring some of his sculptures. Let's hear some of our conversation. So, art has been a passion for you from early on. I'm wondering what your earliest memory is of being affected by art of any kind, whether a book or a picture or a song, where you realize the potential power of art
to affect us on a deep level rather than just entertain us?
I think my first memory of encountering art, my mother covered one of my notebooks, my first grade notebook, with a Velázquez painting, one of the Meninas. And I will look at it every day in school, probably trying to be distracted from first grade assignments. And I looked at it, and I was sort of was enamored by, with that painting and with that little girl and what she was thinking and feeling. And she was probably maybe about my age or maybe a couple of years older than I was.
And how old were you?
I was probably, you know, first grade, 6 or 7,
right.
Probably 6.
Yeah.
So that really was my first encounter with a work of art formally, even though it was not the real work. It was just some paper my mom covered my notebook with, but it was enough to affect me.
To sort of stir you on a level which perhaps other things hadn't.
It felt like a completely different kind of experience, even though I didn't understand why it was.
Right, yeah.
And the idea that I could relate to the psychology of something that was obviously painted, that was also interesting, that I could look at the eyes of this little girl and somehow something will be evoked by that stare, even though I was conscious of the fact that I was not looking at a photograph or anything.
Yeah.
That was also surprising, that I will have that kind of reaction for something that was clearly made up.
Yeah. That's interesting. I hadn't really thought about that before, because we accept it from so early on, but it is strange that you can relate to things that are inanimate and they feel real, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they know the idea that you can put consciousness into a flat surface just by the way the eyes were handled or the slight shape of her chin or something, that there was something alive there. And it was maybe not, now I think of it differently. At the time I thought the little girl was alive in some manner. Now, of course, I know that it was Velázquez who was alive in that painting. And so my feelings have changed, but the way I relate to the consciousness in the work sort of remains very similar to when I was a six-year-old.
Yeah. You were born in Cuba, moving to Spain and then Puerto Rico while growing up. Even though you were moving around, did you grow up in a creative environment, would you say, within your family, or is art something that you found for yourself?
The environment was creative in the sense that Cuba was, by the time I was born, 6 years after the revolution, making things up, building things out of nothing, and so on, was very much part of everybody's sort of attitude. There was, you couldn't buy things off the shelf. So even though that is not art in itself, it does require the kind of inventiveness and creativity that we associate with art making. And my dad in particular was very much engaged with those things. He was always building things, building projects. So in many ways, I was very familiar with the inventive idea of creating something out of nothing. That was commonplace in my experience. And I was always drawing and doing things like that. I mean, drawing was the way I related to the changes that were happening in my life. But it really wasn't until I was officially an apprentice for a painter, or officially, I mean, I actually was an apprentice for a painter, until that moment that the experience of art making as such came to me, as opposed to just even the little paintings I made before that, I didn't understand them as art at all. I understood them as trying to record something that was happening to me in the same way I would have spoken to a friend or something.
Yes, yeah. Even though art was such a major part of your life from an early age, you were also very interested in science and decided on reaching adulthood to follow that passion into physics, which you pursued to the doctoral level. You've spoken about reaching a crisis point with regard to choosing between science and art in terms of your career. What made you choose art ultimately? I'm wondering what you can realize of your potential through art that you can't through science.
I mean, I was very interested in the ideas of mathematics and science. I wanted to understand the universe and understand our place in it. But as I got older, I realized there were a number of questions, questions that have to do with questions of being and questions of history and personal history, family history, questions that had no answer I knew, but I wanted to explore them a little bit, like what is regret? How do you navigate a life with regret? Questions like this that as I got older became more and more pressing, more urgent. And I began to feel that going to the lab and investigating lasers, even though I loved it and I enjoyed it, felt like a luxury that I didn't have enough time in my life to just dedicate it just to science, that I wanted to go back and explore these questions that seem unfinished. And that seem a lot more urgent and pressing to my everyday experience than physics was. So I never lost the love for math and physics and the curiosity about the universe. But somehow the urgency of the questions shifted direction in my early 20s.
You said that deciding to move careers from physics to art was your first rebellion. What would you say you were rebelling against?
I think I was rebelling against the expectations of my parents, the expectations of my peers and society. I have done well in school, so everybody sort of creates subtle and not so subtle expectations that you're going to be devoting your life to that which you seem to be good at doing. And my parents, I was the firstborn, the oldest in a family of immigrants. I moved around. My mother in particular come from a family of doctors and so on. It was suspected I would do something like that. In fact, the idea that I would be a medical doctor was unquestioned through my younger years. So taking a step towards something that was unpredictable, unresolved, without guarantees, was a disappointment for everybody. And in that sense, it was a rebellion for the expectations of others, against the expectations of others, in favor of my own expectations of who I was and what I needed to do. So, it was an uncomfortable moment.
After you decided to move from science to art, you moved to Oakland, where I understand you had a day job in science to support your painting, and you've spoken about that period as a terrible time. What sustained you living through the risk and difficulty created by your decision?
You know, I worked for a while as a scientist in Palo Alto, and then I really just supported myself with selling my works in the parks of San Francisco and so on, which was at least how it happened to me. It was not particularly dignified. The only thing that sustained me was what I saw in the artworks that I admired. There was a quality in them that whenever I was ready to give up, reminded me what was possible. Even if I myself could not produce those things, I thought it was a worthwhile aim to continue trying. So I think that was what sustained me, the sense that there was something, a possibility, something great that I felt in front of the great artworks that I admire. And I wanted to be part of that in some way, even if all I was going to do is just keep trying.
Is part of it a kind of need for self-actualization, of realizing yourself in the way that you felt you needed to realize yourself rather than what had been expected?
I think maybe now I can think of part of it that way. Back then, I just wanted to be part of something that I saw outside of myself that I thought was sort of, I thought it was sort of the big fight or the big race, sort of the grand party of sorts. And I wanted to be part of it. I always loved literature. I read these books that transform me and challenge me, and these paintings that I love and so on. And I thought, you know, this is what I want to be doing or trying to do. I mean, I couldn't explain or justify to myself, why wouldn't I be involved in that? Like, how could I just continue on and pretend that that's not there calling me to be engaged with it?
Right.
And just being a passive reader or observer of artworks was just not enough. I wanted to be able to engage with it by making them.
Yes. Yeah.
You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Coplin, and my conversation with special guest, artist and author Enrique Martinez-Celaya. We're going to a break now, but we'll be back with more conversation after these messages.
Like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland? Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com.
No white horses to play the game, and I wish I knew your name. Something about you in the rain. Did I or didn't I say it's forever? Well, I know I said it, babe, it just goes nowhere. Well, we can do the things we want, we can do the things we like, but if we're taking all the time, well, I just don't think that it's right. Just that. I think that there's more to us than just that.
It's a Question of Balance Music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Hi, I'm Casey, and I'm the second generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week, featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com.
Bookshop Santa Cruz is celebrating 50 years of independent bookselling in the community that we love. Visit Bookshop Santa Cruz downtown and join in the festivities as we celebrate our customers and the books that make it all possible. Bookshop Santa Cruz, celebrating an amazing 50 years in downtown Santa Cruz.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest, artist and author Enrique Martinez-Celaya, whom I spoke to at his studio in Los Angeles. Let's hear some more of our conversation.
I interviewed a wonderful YA author recently, Maggie Steve Otter, and in her new book, All the Crooked Saints, there's the following observation. By relegating the things we fear and don't understand to religion, and the things we understand and control to science, we rob science of its artistry and religion of its mutability. And it's very common to separate out and stereotype science and art, even perhaps presenting them as the antithesis of one another. Coming from a place where art and science are obviously very much part of your being, I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this division. I mean, it seems unhelpful and unnatural to me, but it's pervasive.
I mean, this separation of these spheres comes all the way from the Enlightenment in the late 18th century. And I am very interested in the idea of holistic knowledge, knowledge that is more complete than this isolation. Mm. I don't understand the separation between ethics and aesthetics. To me, they are one and the same. Mm. And the notion that we will look for guidance or clarification or ethical luminosity of sorts in religion, I and not in art, to me seems surprising that we relegate art to that which is decorative, which is a shock or a joke of some sort. Mm. And when we want to get serious, we go to religion or we go to philosophy. Mm. And to me, that's just absolutely not the case. I'm interested in art as a way to acquire knowledge, to get ethical guidance, to find my way through the world. So I want to look at the totality of experience as a complete knowledge, which is not separate into little spheres, but that it brings in theology, that it brings aesthetics, science, ethics, all of it comes together to try to make sense of what is ultimately a very confusing reality.
Mm, yes, yeah. Moving back to when you first started out, you've written about how hard it was to be an unknown artist. You moved from your science career to art. I'm wondering if you remember the first painting that you sold and how that felt, both in terms of receiving money for your art, but also giving up your work so that it's out of your possession. I mean, maybe a more major piece, I guess, if you were selling stuff in the park, or maybe that counts, I don't know, but that sort of sense of the first time you felt, okay, I've sold something properly, and what that felt like. But also I'm interested in what it feels to, you know, give something up that you then won't see again, possibly.
Yeah, I mean, I remember those first few sales. They felt great in many ways. It was kind of like agriculture. I planted carrots, I pulled them out of the ground, I brought them to the market, and somebody gave me some money for it.
Yeah.
And that sense of nurturing something that then somebody else wants, and you feel less alone because of it, not only is money that is trading, but is acceptance and feeling somewhat in the company of someone else.
Yeah.
Once somebody says, you know, I like, or I feel enough for what you're doing that I'm willing to trade money for it, one feels slightly less alone for it. So it's not just this commodification aspect. It's a sense of communion and connection with someone else. And it validated, you know, the choice of having done this, at least for a moment.
Right.
The questions came back, like, you know, soon thereafter. But for a moment, it confirmed that maybe I was on the right track, and that maybe I would be able to support myself after all. So it was empowering. That's maybe the word for it. It was empowering, and I was grateful for it.
Mm. What about giving something up? Is that an aspect you've ever felt with your paintings, like something that you really love, and then someone takes it away, and that's, I mean, you can have a photograph of it or whatever, but it's not the real thing. Is that something you've ever felt, or is that just seem natural as part of the process?
It has been hard to give things up. I don't make enough work, and I make all my own work, so I don't, it's not like I have a production line. So whenever I give something up, quite often I wish I could keep it.
Mm.
The positive side of it is that so often the people who do buy my work have place it in a position that makes a sense to their life and their family, and it's a central position often. Well, for me, maybe I will have it just in my storage. But still, there are many pieces that I have regret selling. And when I was younger, I sold some things that I deeply regret. Like I sold one of my sketchbooks in San Francisco, and I will forever feel that was a mistake.
Yeah.
So, and I have managed to keep some of my work, and I try actively to keep something, although it's not always easy, but I try to keep something from each body of work, so at least I have a connection to it.
I know you've written that perhaps it's not helpful for artists to think in terms of sort of figurative rather than abstract, but you use a figurative approach. I'm wondering what appeals to you about that.
I feel that paintings are best when they are a mixture of presence and reference. The presence of the materials and the physical experience of the object itself, which we feel in our bodies and in very visceral response, but also the reference. It points and alludes to something that is our lives, is how poetry comes to be often into the work. I know I'm familiar with, and I appreciate occasionally, the arguments for the removal of this, which many people consider to be a burden, particularly modernist traditions, consider to be a burden onto the work, the literary references, the philosophical burden, the story component of paintings. But I think without them, paintings tend to drift within the realm of the decorative. And
within the realm?
Of decoration, of the decorative.
Right.
And I feel a certain connection to the world as we experience it is important to painting, as it is to literature. I think in many ways, words, poetry and so on, despite sort of modernism and so on, they were always connected with reference, always connected to alluding to something in particular rather than just disconnected words. Although, of course, concrete poetry and so on attempted to do this. So for me, images are important, but they're always kept in check against the presence and the materials themselves. And the stories or the references are always fragmentary. The narratives always are broken up in order to reconcile themselves against the experience of painting. So this is important. Now, there are many elements within my work that have a lot of allegiance to what one would normally describe as non-figurative work.
The elements of the unseen, I would say, of representing what is unseen.
It's what is unseen, but also the way they're handled themselves. People who see my work in real life realize that what may seem like a face or the ocean quickly in real life breaks down into marks and very aggressively painted passages which destroy the image. And this aspect of representation, of creating an image and then undermining it to reveal or to acknowledge that it is a painted image, is very important. When you see my work in reproductions, they seem much more subservient to an image and to a figurative element than they are really in real life. In real life, they seem a lot less figurative than they appear in photographs.
I would say that's true. And I think you just can't replace seeing a work of art in its original form in front of it, can you? I think Leonardo da Vinci said, "Art is never finished, only abandoned." What is your process, both for completing a body of work and also an individual painting within that body of work?
So I often begin a body of work with writings, not necessarily writings that will form the content of the work, but rather writings that clarify where I am mentally in regards to the work. And then I work on many pieces together, and that sort of totality helps each individual piece be clarified. And the process of finishing a work is always tricky. There are works that I never manage to finish or take years to finish. And other ones that seem to come together much faster. But Leonardo's quote is probably true to an extent, but I would like to add to that the reason I step away from the work is because it is as good as I can make it today with who I am. 10 years later, when something has been understood differently or clarified, sometimes it is possible, not always, to go back to a work that had frayed intellectual edges in it and sort of complete those works. But I try not to go too often into works of the past because I am someone else by then. And I don't like to disrupt the work of that younger artist that I was quite often. Sometimes I do, but it's always a risk.
And I think it's also like the process of living. You know, if you look back, like you were saying with your sketchbook, you know, things we might regret. I think if we can think that If we were living in a way where we were doing the best that we could at any one point, then we can't ask more of ourselves than that, because like you say, you're not the same person, you know, looking back as you are today. So I think that's part of living too, as well as the artistic process. Would you agree?
Yeah, it is. And it's also, it's kind of like looking at yourself as a 14-year-old. You can see some things there, uncooked and unfinished, but you can't pick things apart. You know, that 14-year-old was a totality of sorts.
Yeah.
So if you were to try to improve upon this little part and this little part, you have to take in the whole, you know, and it wouldn't work. You can't piecemeal improve upon a 14-year-old, and you can certainly not take the whole anymore, because your connection is lost to what was relevant at that time. So going back to an earlier work, in some ways mean taking on the totality of consciousness that made that work, and that is not possible. Mm-hmm. So only certain works will accept that sort of revisit.
Mm. You create some very large works, both paintings and sculpture. What appeals to you about going big?
I think in big works is that I find that balance between presence and reference that I mentioned before, where the paintings have a physical presence, a sense of being a force to contend with in themselves, and also a reference, an allusion to a place different than where you're standing, which is ultimately what images do.
Mm.
And that balance, that equilibrium, even if it's an unstable equilibrium, it comes much easier in large paintings. The reason I try to do small paintings is because I refuse to give up on the possibility that occurs also in smaller works, although I have to work 10 times harder in a smaller work. I think large paintings is very easy to make them intimate, even though people think of largeness as not intimate. I think that smaller painting tends to become very quickly a window, and that window is always a projection. It's always hard to be intimate with a window. You're intimate with what you see through a window, not with the window itself.
Yeah.
But a large painting is a dwelling, a place to be, in a way that you can really be intimate with.
Yeah, that's true.
You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my conversation with special guest, artist and author Enrique Martinez Celaya. And if you'd like more information about Enrique, if you go to the show website, itsaquestionofbalance.com, and click on the guests tab at the top, you'll be able to find the podcast page that will be up for Enrique Martinez Celaya. And you'll be able to see some pictures of his work, get the link to his website, and get more information. So do check that out afterwards. We're going to go to a break now, but we'll be back after these messages with more conversation.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made dessert in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Daniel, and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Can you imagine living without stress, anxiety, or fear? And can you imagine a life filled with harmony and inner peace? Is that even possible? The Ananda Yoga and Meditation Center in Scotts Valley offers simple tools to help you become more effective at work and more centered in the face of life's challenges. At Ananda, we offer yoga classes for everybody, inspiring workshops, devotional chanting, and Sunday services based on the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. Our teachers and therapists are highly trained professionals who work together to inspire a healthier you. And your first Ananda yoga class is always free. Visit us at anandascottsvalley.org or call 338-YOGA. That's anandascottsvalley.org or 338-YOGA.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copeland, and my special guest, artist and author Enrique Martinez-Celaya, whom I spoke to at his studio in Los Angeles. And just to remind you, I'm featuring a three-part series of interviews with Enrique, so do look out for the follow-up shows in coming weeks. Well, let's hear the last part of our conversation for this week.
You're incredibly well-versed in literature, science, philosophy, and art, which informs your work. I'm wondering what you feel is the access point in art for people without that intellectual background. How necessary is it to understand how a work came into being in order to appreciate it?
I feel the role of intellect and intelligence is to get itself out of the way. So I think that the reason why I read and think about these problems is to make fine distinctions that I couldn't do otherwise. Mm. But if I have thought about something deeply enough, then it doesn't need the armature around it of the whole intellectual development that got me there.
For the person viewing it.
For the person viewing it.
Yeah.
I think I needed that to get myself to a place that I can make that fine distinction or that elusive kind of insight into the work as it reveals itself. Also, literature and philosophy and so on give me certain standards of what it means to say something is great, or what it means to say something is perceptive or deep or intelligent. So it gives me a bar of sorts to aim towards, and to know when I should be dissatisfied with what I'm producing. So in many, many ways, all that intellectual machinery is for my personal use. They are tools. Mm. So in the same way that when you look at a house, you don't necessarily need to know which hammer was used and which nail was used, I think that that's the same way that I relate to all this background I have and all these things I use. When intelligence and intellect are at the forefront of a work of art or a piece of literature, is always uninteresting to me. And it's always a sign that the work is mediocre, in my opinion.
Yes, yeah, I think I would agree with that. To be an artist, one has to have mastery over the use of tools and materials and techniques. I'm wondering how you see that practical necessity interweaving with the more intangible aspects of creating art. Is it possible to create great art without good knowledge of technique and materials?
Is it possible? I suppose it's probably possible, and there are some people who have
some people who are trying to say it's possible.
Yeah. But I would say it is possible in the same way that it is possible to be enlightened overnight without no effort. But it's unlikely.
Right.
So I think that there are a lot of examples of people who, for whatever reason, themselves or life or special gifts, make them such that they make profoundly resonant works with very little knowledge and very little knowledge of materials. Those are deception.
Yeah.
And to bet one's life that one is one of those gifted people who is channeling the universe in one's work is a bad bet. Mm. I think the better bet is to say, I better know something, I better understand something, and maybe with that I might be able to produce something. That's a better bet than thinking that I'm just so gifted and my hands is so amazing.
Yeah.
That's something we'll produce without our knowledge. However, that second bet, a lot of people do it. A lot of people think that there's something so interesting going on with them and with their ideas, which are often quite trivial actually, that what comes out of them will be glowing, even if they know very little, they have very few technical skills. Mm. More importantly, they have very little understanding because they have spent not enough time thinking and doing and seeing.
Mm.
So what can possibly come out of it? But they rely, and often accurately, on the lack of knowledge of the surrounding people and the amnesia of those around them. So they come up with this little trivial idea, and the other people around don't know any better, so everybody says, great, because it looks super fantastic.
Mm. Well, there can be a sort of marketing element almost, isn't there? And then, I don't know, I think with some things it's almost like the emperor's new clothes, you know, it just becomes the thing and everybody's like, well, I don't know that I like it or I don't quite understand it, but everyone else does, you know, and it just creates a sort of, I don't know, movement. But I think it's those kind of things, at least in my perception, that have unfortunately turned a lot of people off from art as well, or understanding what really art is.
Right, I mean, it is one of those things that does, I mean, there's certain hostility to contemporary art, with some of which it has to be there, but people don't find it something that matters in their life, partly because it's hostile. They don't want to spend the time, and the time is often not rewarded. So that's why the larger society finds art irrelevant. But the emperor's new clothes idea of art, I mean, it has become more problematic to the point that a great or large sector of that population doesn't know to begin with what clothes are. So it's not that they look at it and said, oh, the emperor's not wearing no clothes. It's that for many of them, the very idea of what a clothes is vague.
Right.
So now they go, well, maybe those are clothes. So it's not only that they're just listening to what everybody else is saying, it's that we have eroded over the last 150 years the idea of clothes and clothing to the point that now when we see the emperor walking naked, even without hearing anybody else, we say, well, maybe those are clothes.
Mm. Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it. Mondrian and Kandinsky felt that art should provide people with a spiritual element, and I know you don't like the word spiritual because it embodies a lot of people think they know what it means, and perhaps we should think of it more as being of the spirit. So I'm wondering what your feelings are on this with your own work, and whether it's implicit in a work of art, or do you think it has to be part of the conscious impetus of the artist to bring in that element of the spirit, and is it part of your impetus?
I think the idea of the spirit in the way that maybe Hegel will speak of it in a sort of some sort of overarching word for all aspects of mind that includes feeling and what other people would describe as heart, or when other people describe as thought, and in that sense that all of what you are in that sense of the spirit, in the sense of a total mind, will be challenged or brought forth or exhorted by the work of art. I think in that sense I agree with sort of Kandinsky's ideas and Mondrian's ideas. And I think that is in the sense that they refer to spirit.
Mm.
the operating sense there is a certain totality, a certain wholeness to who engages the work. It's not just your mind that engages the work, or not just your thoughts engage the work, but all that one is, as not just cognition, not just heart.
On a more practical note, nearly every arts event I attend, and I don't know, maybe I'm attending the wrong ones, but the predominant demographic is people over 60, and the next most common would be over 40, and there are hardly any young people at art openings, theatre performances, etc. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on how we can engage the young in a deep way with the arts, beyond simply a form of entertainment or a more superficial kind of interaction with it through, say, social media, whatever. I mean, there is this way we're moving forward to have a very shallow interaction with many, many things instead of a deep interaction with less things. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I mean, there are some openings that you cannot find anybody above 40. So that also exists. And I think that there are some artists and some galleries and some institutions that are mostly predominant. The audience is mostly the young. That doesn't negate what you're saying. I mean, I think that it does talk of an art world that is fragmented into little audiences. And if you are sort of in this particular sliver, you're not really engaged with this other sliver of the art world. I think that I think what both of them, what is common to both things, is to the old audience or to the young audience, is often we could use more education on both sides. We can, and by education I mean ultimately the right exposure. There is a tendency for the exposure, whether social media or other means of disseminating sort of the arts, to speak that way of the arts. I love the arts. Nobody says I love religions. I mean, if you say I love religions, it means that you don't really believe in anything. You sort of love religions in a way an anthropologist might love religions as a subject of study, but not as something you yourself are engaged with.
Yeah.
So when you say I love the arts are battlefields. You know, painting is a battlefield. If you love all painting, it's very difficult to imagine you love any painting very much.
Yeah.
So the kind of education I think we need is an education in those polemics of what art is, not in a sector of culture that we got to become familiar with or engage with for acculturation purposes, but rather to be exposed to the polemics and battles present to show both the young and the old that these things matter to someone, that they actually, that this, the artists who made this or the writers who wrote this gave their lives and the best of who they were for something they truly believed, and those beliefs are often contrary to what somebody else believed in that same subject. And that liking all of it usually means you didn't understand it very well.
Yeah, that makes sense. What do you think are the most important character traits for forging commercial and artistic success in the arts? And I don't know if you would differentiate between those two things. Maybe it's different traits for each. But
I mean, I think one of the most important aspects of one character that needs to be there is resilience. Because from the moment that you first put yourself out there, you get rejection after rejection after rejection.
Yeah.
So if you're not resilient and self-driven, and you needed to have more validation in order to continue on, then chances are you won't last too long in this business. I think in terms of the outside world, I would say that's the quality. In terms of one's own search as an artist, the most important qualities have that bullshit meter that Hemingway spoke about. To be able to recognize when you're working, the way in which you're lying, the ways in which you're propping.
Lying to yourself.
The way you're propping half understood ideas to seem like you get them better. The way in which you're repeating yourself just because it's familiar and you know the success of that repetition. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things, those kinds of forms of authenticity, of honesty, are critical if your work is going to at least have the possibility of being something other than a hack. So I think that those are that bullshit meter is the most important thing as a in terms of your work and resilience in terms of the world.
Interesting. And finally, obviously, your life is embedded in your art. But what keeps the creative passion alive for you? Like you just finished a body of work. You're working on a new body of work. You know, what is driving you?
I think what drives me is that same sense that I had at the beginning, that I would like to understand life better, to understand the choices I make better, to understand what's around me and reality better. And it's always an unfinished effort. And when I finish a body of work, I have a big list of things that elude me and that and incomplete things and that brings me back to the studio to try to sort them as well as I can, and there are paintings I want to see that I have never seen, and so when I do that and I want to see, understand what art is ultimately, and that's what brings me back to it.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Well, thanks again to Enrique Martinez-Celaya for taking the time to talk to me. As I mentioned, this interview is part of a 3-part series of conversations with Enrique, so look out for the follow-up shows in coming weeks. Thanks for listening, and I look forward to being with you again next time.